Welcome to another PI World podcast. This is an audio-only version offered as another way to enjoy our great content. A full video version can be seen on piworld.co.uk, where you can find many more videos of interest to investors.
Good morning. Biome Technologies. I'm Paul Mines, Chief Exec. And if you have looked at your computer or looked at your mobile phone this year and read a story about plastics, I think pretty well everyone in the room's done that, then you will be looking and exploring the space we're operating in, which is the bioplastics market, and you will probably have used the technology that we provide that supports the fibre optic network of the UK broadband rollout. So you know, we provide the stuff that empowers both the internet and is changing the way plastics are perceived. So Biome Technologies is a growth-oriented, commercially driven technology group listed on AIM. We have two divisions. One's called Biome Bioplastics, and that's in the rapidly developing market for bio-based and biodegradable plastics. And we have a second division called Stenalco RF Technologies, which is in the market for radio frequency heating and producing optical fiber furnaces. Both divisions have a track record in commercializing technology, and our group strategy is around developing IP and know-how and selling to international customers. Just an overview of the group in terms of key data. Graph on the right is annual sales per year and annual EBITDA per year. So we listed on AIM in 2010. After a sort of slowish start, the momentum started to build over the last few years. Our nomad is Allenby Capital. We've been EBITDA profitable from 2017. And we haven't done a half year on this, but our half year, first half 2018, revenues were 4.4, EBITDA was a half. 42 employees, current market cap about 13 million. Depends on the day. So first of all, I'm going to talk about the bioplastics division, which is what we think has got the sort of most sort of investor upside potential. And I'm going to start with that picture. And I'm sure unless you've been hiding under a rock, you kind of helped at seeing the plastics debate this year. And David Attenborough did a great job of PR for us earlier in the year. So you know, one view of plastics is that they're the curse of the earth. But you know, they'll be in your car, in your plane, and they're essential to making sure the food that arrives at your supermarket is fresh, unbruised, etc. So the plastics aren't going, even though they're being billed as a curse at the moment. What are we? Biome Bioplastics is a leader in the field of both bio-based and biodegradable materials. We tend to focus on sort of high-value applications around food packaging, food preservation. We do some work in plastic bags, but tend not to focus on that just because the margins aren't particularly interesting. We've got an international sales portfolio. Over 80% of our sales go into North America. We also have a sort of a cutting-edge biotechnology program, which I'll come back to on the next generation of plastic materials. And certainly in the last year, we sort of see we're at the sort of the centre of the UK's government's view of how they're going to change the plastics market in the UK, and we've received something over 4 million now of government funding to explore new plastics. The market is changing. There's been a change to the view of greenhouse gas emissions and also the environmental damage that plastics in the ocean and our rivers cause. I'd also say that the performance of bioplastics is improving, and that as we put more technology in, as others do as well, they're able to provide solutions for a growing number of applications. We have seen in the last year a real upswing in business in interest from larger multinationals, as well as I would typify our current portfolio is all sort of medium-sized companies, both in Europe and North America. What I would say, you know, bioplastics are more expensive than oil-based plastics at the moment, and typically 2 to 4 times the price of oil-based plastics, and that limits their adoption to typically higher added value applications or where legislation demands them. But we've seen that sort of ceiling of interest coming down into larger volumes over the last year and more development work in broader mass market items. If you read around this market, you know, the sort of expectations are is it'll grow at sort of 30% a year over the next few years, and the sort of the biotechnology market itself will be huge in the next few years as well. Just to give you sort of a local context, I've picked, so plastics are made from oil and gas, you all know that. And typically as oil and gas is converted into monomers, and as that happens, CO2 is released and plastics are made. So globally, about 7-8% of CO2 emissions come from the manufacture of plastics. That's about the same as aviation in total. So it's not an insignificant portion of total greenhouse gas emissions, but neither is it a dominant. The dominant emissions are from heating and road transportation. Then those plastics go on to products and packaging, and in the UK they reach their end of life at some point, and about 3.7 million tonnes a year reach their end of life in the UK, to give you a context. And then, despite all our best efforts and your trips to the segregating your plastic, only about 10% of that plastic actually gets recycled in the UK. And if you've read some of the stuff going around at the moment, you'll have understood that this has really become exposed in the current year. About 25% is said to be recycled and may be recycled. It disappears off to what was China, now Indonesia, Bangladesh, etc. for recycling. So one can think about 35% of the UK's plastics is recycled in quotes, and then 35% incinerated, 22% landfilled, and 8%, probably 8% doesn't go into the environment. It's just not difficult to account for it all. So that's the sort of current model of what's going on in the UK. The government is not supporting R&D around incineration due to sort of public acceptability reasons. There are different government approaches. Germany does accept more incineration. If I then layer on the space we're working in, we take biomass, typically farm trees from Scandinavia or potato starch from Northern Europe or corn starch from North America, and make it into plastics. That goes on to products and packaging. And then at the end of its life, we would say you can landfill it, you can incinerate, and indeed you can recycle it, but you know, the infrastructure doesn't exist at the moment. That 10% is largely PET bottles and a few percent of HDPE bottles. But for biodegradable materials, and we would advocate they're suitable particularly for sort of food contaminated items. So at the moment in the UK, no plastic films are recycled. Please someone prove me wrong, but I've not seen anywhere where plastic films are recycled. And yet it sort of forms 30% of UK packaging. And we would say that's the ideal target for compostable materials, often contaminated with food waste. They can then go off to biodegradation in AD or composters. So that gives you the opportunity we see in the UK to change that. And is it actually changing? Well, earlier this year, something called the UK Plastics Pact was enacted. This is a coming together of retailers, brands, and the government, to some extent, RAP, it's called. And they've declared that by 2025, and this is important for us, all packaging will be reusable, recyclable, or compostable. And 70% of it will be recycled or composted. And this is, and this slide gives some view of those. This represents about 70% of the packaging supply chain in the UK that signed up to this. It's not legislation, but this is what this group is committed to. But I hope it gives you a view of the direction of travel in the UK at the moment, which is either recycle it, not a lot of it's going to be reused, frankly. It's either recycle it or compost it. And there's a lot of background work now going on, making sure we've got the composting facilities in place to accept that kind of uplift in materials. So what's our business? We've been a focused bioplastics business since 2012. We develop and make bioplastic compounds. We work typically on 2 to 4 year development cycles with medium to large end users. We have a low capex model. We make our materials in hired facilities in the UK, Germany, and the US. All our products are compostable at the end of their life. 80% of our sales outside the UK. And in recent RNSs, we've explained that we've got a number of large-scale projects that we expect to break early in 2019. As a slight aside, but just to sort of illustrate how we're looking at the next generation of materials, we've received now over £5 million of funding to look at using engineered organisms, this is genetic modification if you want, but to change microorganisms to feed on waste and make the next generation of plastics. We've done that with 5-6 universities, predominantly in the UK, but some in continental Europe. We filed for patent applications, and we're now seeking to sort of look at the economics behind that and see whether we can bring them to market in the next couple of years. So as well as the sort of current portfolio products, we've got a handle into the next generation of materials as well. And now for something completely different, a step into OEM equipment manufacture. And I'm sure there'll be a question of why are these two businesses in the same group, but they are. Bear with me for the moment. So the Stenalco radio frequency business is a specialist OEM business. It's been around, in fact, this business has been around since the 40s. Basically, it uses electromagnetic waves to do heating. So rather like your microwave, but it operates at a different frequency and it heats up metal and carbon and plastics. We think, the market leader in the market for providing the furnaces that support making fibre optic cable. So typically fibre optic cable is made in a sort of a 4 or 5 storey building, large machine in the middle of it. And then in the middle of that second floor down is a furnace that melts the glass to about 2,200 degrees. And off the bottom of that glass is drawn the wafer thin, hair thin piece of fibre optic cable. Glass at that point is then bundled up and made into cables. And those of you who've followed us have seen over the last few years, driven by sort of huge changes in data demands for the internet, we've seen an unprecedented expansion of capacity. And you know, so typically, sort of the year before last, we made 20 new furnaces. This current year, the number will be around 40. So we've ramped up very quickly. We've taken some more premises in Southampton. The team have been great, actually. And you know, what we can see is just this wall of data requirement over the next few years driving demand for more and more cable. And particularly as we move to 5G, there might be a few experts in the room, but although the 5G mobile signal gives you much better data on your phone, the mobile masts are much closer together and all those masts have to be connected by cable between the masts. So there's a drive for more and more cabling to support that data capacity. And on here, 70% of our revenues are into the wider Asia. That's particularly into India and China, as you might expect, where you know, in China, all new homes are cabled up with fiber optics. Right from the word go, they're sort of missing out the copper to the home type thing. So this is sort of the fiber optic market. It gives you an idea of what the unit looks like. They operate at a temperature is hotter than the space shuttle, I would say. So this is a bit of rocket science, but on the ground. And as you see, we've scaled up production threefold in the last 12 months. We do a range of other products as well. And sort of despite the fact that the fibre optic market's growing, we're seeking to broaden the business base. And these are a few metal boxes. This one on the left-hand side is used for joining fibre optic cable. The others are particularly used for sort of heating either precious metals or steel or blade hardening, that kind of work as well. And we're gradually pushing back, trying to push in industrial applications, push, if you like, conventional heating technology out and try and get customers to use RF. It's more expensive, but more controlled. So we've got good repeating revenues from sort of power generation, medical and general industrial markets. We've launched recently a set of standard power supplies to the industrial market, which are selling well. We've got a number of customer projects where they're paying for the R&D of new developments that we hope come to pass in the next few years as well. But we'll remain that sort of specialist, sort of application solution-focused business. You know, we see potential for growth in this business, but not the kind of transformational numbers that we've perhaps seen in the bioplastic side. So what is our investment proposition? We've got two distinct divisions, bioplastics, high performance products, emerging technical pipeline in our industrial biotechnology. and with rapid change of the public perception. We've got to steer our way through that, but a real opportunity for significant growth. The radio frequencies division is cash generative and it's got a really good market position in fiber optics, and we've got scope to broaden that more widely. The compound growth has been 30%, 37% over the last 4 years. We moved into EBITDA profitability in 2016, and we've got cash balances of $2.5 million at the end of September. So that's allowed us to put a bit more investment into both development and sales resource during 2018. The board, we sort of have a sort of 3-year business planning cycle without getting too dry about it, but the targets over this cycle from 2018 to 2020 are compound revenue growth of 25%, and particularly with 40% growth in the bioplastics business. We're, as many sort of SMEs, you know, we've got a number of customers who are a large proportion of our revenue. So one of the other tasks we've got to do as a board is to diversify that, so that the target is by 2020, only 15% of revenues come from any one sector or any one customer. And we've also committed to increase the amount of R&D spend that we have in the business over these next few years as well, because we see ourselves sort of opportunity rich at the moment. And we'll report against these KPIs on a regular basis. So that's it from me. Thank you very much for listening attentively.
Paul, would you be able to say a little bit about the item in the budget about tax on UK manufacturers or importers of plastics, where they seem to be, the suggestion was favouring recycling, and I didn't see any mention of
I think the
composting.
So I think the government's response is to ban some things, like although we've sold an unprecedented amount of material, it's small in revenue terms, but for straws in the last few months, you know, so there's a sort of ban some things, and I think some things will just get banned, little plastic stirrers for coffee cups and things like that. I think then there's a Treasury imperative to use the goodwill that's behind the plastics, the popular view on plastics, to raise more revenue, so some things will get taxed. I think then there's a more sort of fundamental view of we've got to change the plastic supply chain. And I think all of those things are going on at once. And, you know, I don't think we'll particularly benefit from the ban, but we will benefit from, we need a look at the whole supply chain. I think the initial focus coming out of the government activity has been on fixing recycling. As I hope I illustrated earlier on, it's difficult to argue that UK recycling particularly is in a good place if we only recycle 10% of what we actually in the UK. But we've, in the last few months, we also see more funding being put out on the R&D side to come up with new materials, some of which we would hope to benefit from. So I think it's a long answer to a short question. It's a sort of mixed economy, and I think we're in a reasonable place within it.
In your opening comments, you alluded to the fact you've got two divisions that don't appear to be have any synergy.
Yes.
And you said you'd comment on that later.
I thought someone would ask anyway, so they don't.
Could you comment on that and whether you see that being a long-term thing?
I think it's a... but in some senses, it's a historical accident is how we got here. I think both... If I find a link between them, it's about a degree of flexibility, a degree of customization, a degree of responsiveness in a world of large players where we're a relatively small player. Who knows? I mean, at the moment, there are benefits, cost benefits of being in the same building and having the same senior team, and I don't see them as a distraction. Who knows what will happen in the future? It's going to be my answer to that. I think the other part of that, just to carry on, is, you know, we've got a mature business with good cash generation record. We've got a bioplastics business that's likely to require further, you know, organically generated funding to support its growth rate in the next few years.
Good morning.
Morning.
Would you mind telling me how many women you have on your board of directors and in senior management roles?
So our company secretary is a female, and our commercial director on our bioplastics side is female. Our head of business development is female, who's out in the other room. So although we've had previously, although Declan's the current FD, his predecessor was a female. So we have a Right now it's four males on the board, plus a company secretary is female, but we've had a mix over the time. And in the senior management roles have populated with a reasonable balance.
Peter, your sales growth looks very good, but your margin is minute. So are you likely to be able to increase the margins? Or am I looking at wrong data?
I don't know which data.
Which margin you're talking about, the gross margins?
Operating margins shown as very low on stock.
Okay, so the gross margin is reasonable. On the RF side, the gross margin is 55-60%. On the bioplastic side, it's 25-28%. But the net margin reflects that, you know, the gearing of the fact we're a public company with the overhead of accountants and being on the thing. So the net margin is low until we can get more volume and more sales through the business. So
there's an element of relatively fixed overhead that you'll see an element of drop through off the gross margin.
What is your core IP within the furnace business? What do you actually?
It's know-how, frankly. It's know-how. So
you're putting the whole thing together. You're assembling the whole thing.
Correct. So it's a knowledge of materials in terms of. I made the joke about the rocket science, but you know, it's a selection of materials: zirconia, hastelloids, stainless steels that can operate at 2,300 degrees. Plus, it's the electronic circuits that control the radio frequency that keep, you know, to pull a very fine slither of glass, the control is the sort of exquisite bit, and that's what we focus on, and that's what we do. Others try and copy and haven't been successful so far.
Is the competition in Europe, or is it the
our single largest competitor is in Scandinavia, who are an integrated sort of cable making business. So a company called Nexstrom. I would say their advantage might be integration for the whole value chain. I'd say our advantage is a single-minded sort of focus on this technology and continuing to improve it.
You actually have no patent protection within any of that process?
Around the optical fibre, no. On the bioplastic side, yes. But.
I think you alluded to sort of beefing up sales side. Yeah. And it seems to me that now is the time really to go for it, obviously, on the sort of biodegradable plastics. And so could you just talk about that, you know, sales and...
You know, it's been a really interesting year. And, you know, we went from, you know, the inquiry rate of 4 or 5 phone calls, emails a week to sort of in the February, March time on the bioplastic side, having 50 a day, it sort of settled down to sort of 20 a week. But there are such a variety of, large multinationals right down to individual coffee shops saying, I want to change my packaging. Now, you know, we've had to sift our way through that. We have put more investment in. As I said, our sales cycle, because we do technically demanding bioplastics, they don't just sort of drop in. Our sales cycle is typically a couple of years. So, you know, there's an upfront investment to getting to that pipeline through. Now, we started some of that some years ago. So all I would say is a balance of how much you go for it, how much fixed cost you put into the business now to reap the rewards few years later, if you like. So we've upped it. Some of that will have some payback in 2019, some will have more payback in 2020. So it's a balancing act that the board and I consider quite a bit.
Hi, can you give us an idea in the bioplastics business, what is the IP and
two levels of IP, one of which is around, you know, essentially we buy in a whole bunch of components and formulate them, and so we've patented a number of those formulations. So they're end formulations of a plastic resin. So what we don't sell final products, we sell granules of plastics that other people process. Some of those, so we've got some patterns around the granules themselves. We have some also two patterns around some of the processing you do to make them behave like conventional oil-based plastics as well. So that's the current set of technology. And then in the industrial biotechnology space, we've patented some of the genetically the ways in which we've modified organisms and enzymes to get to the next generation of materials as well, and the processes for using those enzymes and organisms as well.
And just
Just follow up. Any idea of the sort of where's the competition or what sort of?
So for bioplastics, there's a large private company in Italy called Novamont, who I'd say are sort of technically good, but with a significant focus on the sort of plastic bags market, and they've really made their play by changing legislation in Italy, which has given them a good base around sort of plastic bags and food produce bags. Then BASF has an offshoot that does some biodegradable plastics, and then there's a Chinese player, and there's a couple of small players in the US as well. So, yeah, it's a small, you know, to give it a context, I think the total bioplastics market at the moment in the world's about 360 kilotons a year. And, but if you compare that to conventional plastics, 330 million tons a year. So it's small number of players sort of jockeying for position, if I can characterize it.
I still don't have any feel for how the kind of plastics you sell is differentiated from commodity bioplastics and how you'll
I think it's mostly the application. So if you come to our stand afterwards, the commodity end of the bioplastics market is typically your caddy bag that you might put your food waste in on, whereas our materials might typically be a 7-layer structure for coffee beans that keeps your coffee fresh for the next year, but also material will compost within 3 months at its end of its life. So there, rather than just providing something that holds your organic waste for a few days until it goes off to a composter, it actually provides protection and moisture barrier, water barrier to the material over a period of time. So the sort of the technology behind providing that kind of packaging is much different from a plastic bag.
So would you say that's replacing things like metallized films, which are quite hard to duplicate the properties
Correct.
Of?
So we have some examples. We actually can metallize our materials, but typically we are providing the kind of barrier that metallized films provide.
Yes, it was really a question about recycling, which carries on from there. So before your plastics can go into more mainstream products, presumably the recipient country needs to have sorted, customised its waste recycling
Correct.
To take account of it.
Correct.
And has that happened anywhere?
Yes, so Germany, Holland, France, Italy, coasts of America.
But not the UK yet, obviously.
It's slow, been slow to the party. I think that's one of the excitements I tried to convey here, that it's changing. I can't predict the path. At the moment, there are 19 sort of composting AD facilities that say they take compostable materials, you know, but if that kind of plastic pact is going to be target, you know, by 2025, you know, and RAP, some of the government, RAP is a sort of government quango doing, you know, is looking now at the infrastructure behind supporting compostable materials, etc. So, yes, you're right, it has to change.
So, in countries like Germany, it actually happens in the home, does it already?
Well, they do they have a green. So we're part of the sort of industry association in the UK, and what we're campaigning for as well is food waste collection, because compostables really sit next to and with the start point is good food waste collection. And you'll be aware that in the UK at the moment, it's almost every different authority is different. And even in London, you get differences. Some do green, some do brown bin, some don't. So if we can get a more standardised treatment of food waste, then the larger companies feel that they can put more compostables out in the market because there is an end-of-life solution.
Well, do you see yourselves as a candidate for a buyout by a big multinational?
Maybe. I mean, at the moment, I'm focused on sort of growing the business organically, and I hope we've shown we're doing that. At a point where we can no longer, you know, respond to the opportunity with our own investment, it would make more sense to do that. But right now, I think, you know, as we're feeling our way, as this market's growing, we can put the, provided we can continue this kind of profitability, we can put the resource into to follow that. At a point where we can't follow it fast enough, it will make a logic to license or sell or something like that.
Paul, in bioplastics, your main sales at the moment are coffee pods, where the demanding features, I suppose, are the air barrier and high temperature operation. Could you say, of all the inquiries that are coming in, what, in broad sense, what are the interesting areas and what are their demanding features
So you're right. One of our sort of biggest successes has been around coffee pods. We're seeing that sort of single serve concept being spread from coffee into sort of other kind of drinks applications, sports drinks, nutritional areas, tea, that kind. So we've had a lot of inquiries, I guess you'd say, from and sort of projects ongoing with sort of upmarket delivery systems around pods that aren't necessarily for coffee. So I'd say that's one area that's come out of it. And so you might expect tea, sports drinks, things like that from that. And then I think in the packaging space, or the more mainstream packaging space, it's the cereal bars, the organic produce, the some frozen produce at the higher value end of materials and things like that is where the inquiries are coming from that I think are likely to lead to sales in the coming months, years.
And would you be able to give any sort of, I mean, you can never promise on time before things happen, but in terms of maybe a couple of things that are, a couple of areas that are
in our last couple of RNSs, we've spoken about, you know, some projects that we believe are, you know, early 2019, first half 2019, gonna break, which we've been working on for a couple of years. So, and we've characterised those in the RNS, which you can see.
Just another quick question. Everybody thinks of biodegradable as great, but what do your plastics biodegrade into, and are there any risks in terms of what they degrade into?
So, I would not advocate that they're an answer to marine litter. You know, these materials do not spontaneously fall apart. They do degrade into carbon dioxide and water. And so we have to demonstrate that, one, they completely disappear within effectively 3 months. Two, that the product of that decomposition is done biodegradably, i.e. it's an enzyme or bacteria that does the breakdown. And then we have to show that the ecotoxicity of the end product is acceptable. And we also have to show that the resulting compost, you then grow seedlings in, and they grow at least as well as compost without the degraded plastic in. So the test for suitable biodegradation is high. And, you know, similarly, we also produce some marine degradable materials. They degrade to carbon dioxide and water. Sometimes there's a few minerals in there, like calcium, talc, something like that as well. But, you know, the trouble with marine degradation is, you know, the sea's different temperature in different places. You know, you haven't got a controlled condition. Some of the clients we're working with, coming out of this recent issue of pollution, are working on materials that, you know, would compost. But if by exception something was to find its way into the environment as well, it would soil degrade or marine degrade. I think that's a difficult path to tread, because it's sort of, are you encouraging people to pitch their bottle over the side of the ship because it says marine degradable on it? I don't know. I think the industry's feeling its way on that, but there are certain things. Someone was talking to me the other day about contact lenses. The amount of contact lenses going down the toilet sanitary system is huge, because people just sit in their bathroom and they, in the end, they end up often back on the land because they're not segregated out by the sewage system. So, you know, can things like that be made to degrade in time? Perhaps, and some of those areas we're sort of doing some work on.
Most of your products to degrade require a degrading facility.
And that's how we would position it. You know, we're not advocating throwing materials into the wild. We do have some customers who do, you know, agricultural customers. People make tree protectors, people who make clips for things in greenhouses and things like that, where they as part of the agricultural cycle, they compost. But to address the plastic packaging market, we would say, no, you need to make sure you identify facilities where the materials will be composted. And typically, you know, they need water, heat. They need to be surrounded by organic material, food waste, grass cuttings, and then they disappear in the way I described earlier.
So do you have any contractual obligation to maintain your just above 1% shareholding and or increase it? I mean, is there any kind of stock option scheme in place?
Yes,
I was hoping you might own a bit more than that.
Oh, yes, I'd like to. but no, I do. I was going to say, watch this space. I do have a stock option scheme. I'm hoping that number will change come December, depending on the moving average of the stock in the next few days.
And what's Mr. Pereira's position?
I mean, he's a private investor. High net worth.
Has he ever sold shares? I mean,
not to my knowledge.
Right.
He's been an investor behind the company for a good 11, 12 years now and built his stake up over that time. All right. Thank you very much, everybody.
PI World videos and podcasts are for general information and interest. They do not constitute any kind of recommendation or inducement to buy shares of any company. PI World is not offering any kind of financial advice, and nothing in our material should be taken as such.